So I hope you're beginning to settle into your seshin mind. It's one way to think about it. The heart and mind that has come to really touch itself and be with itself, where we realize that moment by moment, because of our practices, moment by moment and breath by breath, we are actually right here. And we're not anywhere else. And I know it sounds funny, possibly, to say that to say it that way, but the actual fact that we are where we are is almost always overlooked by people. And the mind tends to have its own agenda. It wants to go where it wants to go. It doesn't really want to necessarily pay attention to that we are where we are. And I looked it up as far back as 1971, Ram Dass tried to help people with this problem of not being where they were, and he wrote that famous book, Be Here Now, which many people found that a very appealing idea, but they also found it a very difficult instruction. And it turns out that almost nobody knew how to do that. And that was one of the things that actually encouraged people to start meditation practices as well. 1971, things were had started, but they really started cooking around that time. So seshin, our practice here, and the attentive presence that it nourishes us is a way for us to practice doing exactly that in all of our activities. So anytime your mind starts to go off on its own trip and its own agenda, just remember, oh wait, I actually have the ability, I have the capacity, and I have the means, because I have this practice, to actually be where I am, as I am, doing what I'm doing. It's not a small thing. In fact, it's increasingly difficult, it seems. I want to talk a little bit at first about this one aspect of Buddhism, in the development of Buddhism. And as I think you probably know, in the evolution of Buddhism, the ideal of the Bodhisattva appeared. The Bodhisattva, of course, is a being who vows to use her own life to awaken and help free from suffering all other beings, or sometimes we say saved, right? We have this idea of salvation in the language. But before that, Bodhisattva allows herself to take the final step of her own full liberation. And in Buddhism, it's a very high ideal. It's sort of the epitome of what's considered a compassionate and an awakened life. And when I have thought about the ideal of the Bodhisattva, and read about it, studied about it, and talked about it, it's my view that before it came into play, people may have practiced with a focus on their own liberation from suffering, which is exactly what the Buddha did. It started out that way. But at some point, people who did have some realization as a result of their practice came to experience, and they came to know without question, just as the Buddha did, that they were not separate from all other beings. And so the idea of their own liberation actually was not quite accurate enough when it came right down to the real fact of practice and realization. And since that was the case, they experienced compassion that naturally flowed from their practice and naturally flowed from the realization toward wanting to help, toward wanting to help other beings to become free from suffering, because in their own lives, it was a very good thing. It was very good. And you probably have experienced, everyone here has experienced seeds of that pull forward in your own lives. I'm sure that that's true. Because it's not foreign to us. It's actually part of what makes us what we are. So it's experiencing this natural flow, we can say, of this connection means, actually experience it means, that we have touched life at its source. Because that's where you find it. It means that we've reached a place where we can feel all of life right here in our own seemingly a small, personal, seemingly separate selves. I say seemingly, but actually when experiencing that, when really knowing that all life is right here, without question, it's seamless. There's no seeming about it. And just as a side note, this is part of the foundation of Dogen saying that when we allow ourselves to be intimate with one Dharma, we are intimate with all Dharmas. Because in exactly the same way, they are all just right there. So entering the gateway of one Dharma enters the gateway of all Dharmas. Experiencing the no-self of freedom from suffering or liberation, or that realization, is experiencing the no-self, knowing in truth of all beings. It is just right there. And I know that this may not be the view of everyone's view of how the so-called Mahayana developed out of the so-called Hinayana. But I've observed in my own practice, my own experience, and I've discussed with others and practitioners over the years, over the decades of practice, that the idea that a separate self experiences some kind of liberation from suffering solely for its own benefit is just not real. It's just, it's not real, it's not realistic, and in contemporary jargon, it's not evidence-based. So we can't say that that's the case, in fact. And it's because of the boundless and the interconnected nature of these non-separate selves. So you cannot find that that's a real thing. The fact is that freedom from suffering means that one is free from suffering. And if we hold ourselves separate from other beings in any part of our hearts or our minds, even for a nanosecond, like that, even faster than that, then in that moment, we are not really free from suffering because of the delusion of that separation. And I think we have to admit that we have many such moments in our lives. Most of our lives are spent in that delusive state, where we are convinced of our own separate being, our own separate nature. And we have a whole culture that supports that. But the delusion that we're separate is the very cause of our suffering. It's so direct. It's very, very clear. And in Buddhism, this delusion of a separate self is called ignorance. It's one of the three poisons. It's how it works it in. And that delusion is not going to be able to win the battle for reality. So that, because reality is always going to, I don't want to say the word, okay, is always going to trump that pesky little non-integrated ego self. Reality will always win that. It was because Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, had this realization of non-separate self when immersed in boundlessness, that Avalokiteshvara was able, in fact, to free all from anguish, as we chant in the Heart Sutra, free all from suffering and fear. So Buddhism is filled with this teaching over and over and over again. Compassion and liberation and realization, just like the rest of our lives, our whole lives, none of it belongs to us as some sort of personal property. And in fact, because none of it does, strictly speaking, belong to us, none of it is ours, then their natural energy causes us to want to be connected to other beings. That natural energy is much wiser than our thinking minds. And so as we practice, we're actually cultivating and developing and deepening our ability to be in that flow of what is actually going on. And that's part of what we're doing here at Sesshin. Nothing less than that. So this is my understanding, and perhaps many of you, some of you have had some experience of this yourself, and so you know what I'm saying. And our practice is so brilliant that if we just follow our breath in Zazen, we can see how inbuilt this is, how natural this is. We can only take an in-breath because we can only hold our breath in for so long, right? Before we know it, our in-breath makes a non-negotiable demand to be released into the world, because our in-breath has filled us up so much that it has to flow out. And if we keep our inhale in, well, you know what happens. We turn blue in the face, right? Or we pass out. A more relevant way to say it is that we might become unconscious, which is a delicious, very delicious trick of language, isn't it? Right? Because it's true, living just for ourselves is a form of unconsciousness. And maintaining that delusion that we're here just for ourselves furthers other kinds of unconsciousness in our life until we just act in this sort of false bubble. But if we allow the inhale to be released, then our lives are nourished quite naturally, and then our lives quite naturally end up nourishing other lives because we're in the flow of reality. That's what's going on. So compassion and freedom from suffering, they work exactly the same as our breath. Our body is a great teacher for what actually is going on. And once we become alive with compassion and awakening, just as we are with our breath, they fill us up, and then they make a palpable demand to be released into the world. And there's been a lot of, I shouldn't say a lot, because I don't think there's been a lot. There's been some discussion of what's called Buddha nature. I'm not sure everybody's talking about it. That word I didn't want to say says everyone's saying that, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of conversation about Buddha nature. But what I'm talking about, this is Buddha nature functioning. If we put aside all kinds of fancy ideas, this is how Buddha nature functions and keeps everything alive as itself. And when Trungpa Rinpoche, who despite all of his controversies, he was a pretty exquisite teacher of the Dharma. When he was asked, what is Buddha nature? He said, basic goodness. And that's not goodness as opposed to badness. This is goodness all the way through. And Trungpa, I think it was very useful for Westerners to hear that there is something basic, fundamental, and it's goodness, and that it is our nature, that it is the nature of all things, as opposed to a lot of the teachings that we've received in our spiritual traditions, which have a different kind of idea. So when we allow our nature to do what it was made to do, it's really quite simple. If we just follow the body, let the body lead the way, because the body's always way ahead of the thinking mind, then we can realize just how embodied Zen practice really is. And we can appreciate this practice that we've given, how it's not that it gets the dots connected, it helps us realize just in which way all the dots are connected already, are right here in our lives. It's pretty miraculous. In a past session, we did a metta practice, a metta meditation, which is a Buddhist practice where we express the wish that we and all other beings are free from suffering and happy, that we are well, both in our lives, both inside our lives and in our lives in general, that we're safe from harm, and as a result, that we find a kind of peacefulness and ease in our life. And today I want to focus a little bit on a part of why and how we suffer, which is why obviously developing compassion and the ability to become free from suffering is so important. And I got the idea when I was looking at one of the illustrations in this new book by my dear friend Kazuaki Tanahashi. And this is not yet time for the great reveal. This is actually my no selfie. Kaz, as you know, is an extraordinary translator of Dogen's text, of Shobogenzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, and other Buddhist texts, and he's a master calligrapher and master painter, and he's in his mid-80s now, and he's all maintains his practice as an active peace activist in his life. So this piece that he painted that I saw in the book is part of what was used as a poster for one of the anti-violence campaigns that he was involved in. And when I saw it, I called him and I said, I want to use your painting. I want to use your painting for my Dharma talk. And he said, oh, that would make me so happy. So now I have permission from the artist. Can you see it? There's the painting there. That's done with one brush stroke. And it asks the question, and it was the question in the painting that really caught my eye, can we stop violence non-violently? I think it's a very good question, especially these days when everything seems to be spinning just nuts in a world of violence. So just take a look. I ask the question, can we stop violence non-violently? Just let yourself see whatever it is that you see in this painting. This is it's not a question that we can ask superficially. This is a question that's meant to be asked at a very great depth. Can you see it okay? Yeah. It's not just something that we can ask with regard to, say, to the surface world of current events. Though if we were able to answer that question in that world that we all live in, it would be a true miracle. But sadly, we can't just snap our fingers, say, oh, I've got the answer, because it doesn't work like that. Thich Nhat Hanh, who most of you, whose name most of you know, Vietnamese Zen master and peace activist himself, he teaches that there is no way to peace, that peace is the way. This is a very important statement. There is no way to get there. There itself is the way. There's no way to peace. Peace itself is the way. And he also teaches with a very challenging statement. And Thay said, you can make peace by yourself. You don't need the other side to agree. That's a mind bender. That really twists people up in a knot. You can make peace by yourself. You don't need the other side to agree. Those who oppose you don't have to agree. So in order to help our bodhisattva vow to become free from suffering and help others to become free from suffering, I want to ask this question where it has to take root before anything can happen. Can we stop violence non-violently? And the only place that we can really ask that question, and the most important place we can ask it, is in the quiet, deep place of the heart and mind, where we can meet ourselves face to face. And we can do that this weekend, thanks to our continuous practice here at Sesshin. This is the right place for that question to be asked. So it's like having a face-to-face meeting or a dokusan with ourselves to ask this question. So I'm going to change the way we do a Dharma talk usually. I'm going to try to make it a little more experiential and embodied, a Dharma talk. So we're going to each have dokusan with ourselves now and have this question come to mind. So I'm going to ask you to please take a very comfortable position on your cushions. Make sure you're comfortable. And in order to start the dokusan, you have to have a bell, right? So the bell is going to be your contact with your own breathing. So please, unlike in zazen, just close your eyes softly. Just very gently and slowly. And let your eyes close completely. And just let yourselves breathe kind of naturally. Take a few quiet, slow, natural breaths to clear the mind. And then let your mind, let your attention, your awareness drift down to your hara, your dantian, your belly area, and breathe from there just like you do in zazen. Often, when people start an exercise, especially in public, for some reason, even though everyone's eyes are closed, they feel anxious. So if you feel anxious, it's fine. Just breathe it in, and then just release it on the exhale. There's no reason to hold on to your anxiety. Don't worry, you'll have some later. You don't have to hoard it. You can let go of this now. But it's important to notice that you actually can let go of it. And this simple letting go of anxiety is one form of making peace with ourselves, even if the other side disagrees. Take that in. We actually can make peace within ourselves, even if some part of us would prefer that we were not so peaceful. We already know how to do it. We have the ability, we have a method, we have a capacity. When we let things go in this way, it sort of erases the slate. The mind and the heart get together. The heart eases the mind. We release, and the mind eases the heart. And the body releases anything that's binding it, anything that's holding onto it too tightly against itself. And self begins to trust self. And pretty quickly we can find that in fact there is already peace and a sense of ease right here inside of us. If we just create the conditions for us to experience it. So please do this and then keep your quiet, attentive breathing going. But really listen to what I'm trying to say to you now. If we want to answer the question, can we stop violence non-violently? We want to be effective. We have to ask the question at the source of worldly violence, which is, of course, within ourselves. It doesn't come from somewhere else. And so when we learn how to make it real inside of ourselves, when we come out of our meditation and step back into the world at large, we can actually do something of real effect and use. And this is one way that our practice helps our outer and our inner worlds to come together as just a one world. So it's important that as you do the exercise, you do it without making any judgment about yourself at all. If we can just accept whatever comes through our mind without making a judgment about it, that orientation alone is also making peace, even if there's something or someone that opposes it. Just being non-judgmental. And I want to say that I really mean non-judgmental, because often, even the positive judgments we make about ourselves are tinged with a little stickiness. They can get a little sticky and egoistic. Like, oh, I'm such a great guy. So we just let ourselves find out what's inside. We'll do that. I'm going to ask you a few questions, though it comes down to one question, really. But just ask and then allow whatever comes to come as an answer to you, naturally and spontaneously and intuitively. So you just ask and then you just listen. Just be. And that's compassion in action. Just like that. So violence has many faces, many cousins, many relatives, and almost all the ways that we have learned to hurt ourselves, we learned when we were very young. We're not born with them. In fact, they are not our nature. In some cases, there are people whose brains are hardwired against themselves. But by and large, these ways are learned and they're not our nature, they're inheritances. They're inherited from our families and our culture. And they make us feel a kind of ill inside. So here's a question I'd like to, you to ask yourself. How do I tend to be unkind to myself? I'll give you some examples of ways to ask this basic question, which is, how do I hurt myself? How do I cause myself to feel badly? How might I be too pushy with myself, or aggressive with myself, or maybe even violent against myself, even though I don't want to be? How might I treat myself in a way that makes me feel smaller, makes me feel ashamed, or that scares me, even though I know I'm a good person? So the short version is, how do I hurt myself, and in what circumstances do I tend to do this? Now please ask this question. May take being a little brave to do it, but just ask and just trust what you're told. And breathe quietly. Your breathing will help keep you calm and not reactive. How do I tend to hurt myself? And in what situations do I do it? Love yourself enough to ask and to answer. I think we know how to answer this question. So when you have some sense of it, you can just sit. You can open your eyes slowly, please, because you're coming back into a light room. And just sit quietly with having asked the question and what the answer is. Just sit with the answer. No need to do anything about it. Let yourself know. And then here comes the other part of the Dokusan with yourself. I'm going to ask you to close your eyes again. Just breathe calmly as you did before. It's brave of you to do this. And trust that there is, in fact, a Buddha right here where you are. There's a Buddha who is being here now, and it's you. There is someone awake inside of you. And so, having asked this question, I'd like you to ask the Buddha inside of you, what nonviolent approach can I take within myself to help me help the part that causes me harm? What nonviolent approach can I take to help that part that hurts me? And then just listen to whatever the reply is. How can I stop that violence nonviolently? And let yourself be open to any response. Don't push anything away. Let the part of you that knows how to make you whole again, because you are whole, let it help you. And the more specific the prescription, the better. It's like a medicine for an illness. Real specific. And let yourself fill with the breath of that for a minute. Open your eyes slowly again and just sit with the answer. So we don't need to hear the illness, but I think it would help people to hear some of the cures that occurred to you. And just, you can say it briefly, but
love.
Yeah, and love is good. And when I say be specific in the prescription, what does love look like?
Tender, nurturing, holding yourself.
So holding the part that causes the harm, not violently rejecting it. Okay, good.
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness to the part that causes the harm. Very good. That's also love, right? Yeah, it's all love. Being attentive to my true needs. Yes. Right. Not these other kind of needs that only end up getting me in trouble, but really, you know, do I really need to be doing this to myself? No, I don't. I need to be doing this for myself. Right? Yes. Bringing attention to it.
Recognizing harmful thoughts and letting them go as I bring them in.
Right. Right. Recognizing this thought is harmful thought. And rather than inviting it in for tea, using the practice to let it go and recognize that its nature, as are all things, is empty. It is not a it does not have to be a permanent guest unless you install it as one. And why would we do that? Brilliant. It's great. Others?
Being willing to apologize to myself for sudden violence.
So, being willing to apologize to myself for sudden violence. So, being willing to be the bigger self that says, you got a little caught there, hey? I'm sorry. I'll treat you better next time. That's right. Because that, I'll treat you better next time, acknowledges that something happened and gives a new path for how to treat the self. Wonderful. These are all nonviolent solutions to violence. Anybody else?
Eating properly.
Say it again?
Eating properly.
Eating properly. Yeah, because very often the way we eat is a kind of violation of our body. It causes us a lot of sickness. It makes us suffer very deeply, which makes our family suffer and our friends suffer and the community suffer. Just eating better is a nonviolent solution. And making sure that the food supply and the water is healthy. This is a nonviolent solution to violence. And on a global scale, the violence is done in the name of corporate greed, we call it, right? The nonviolence is done in the name of life itself. So you can see that it's eating properly is a sacred act, actually. It's a brilliant form of nonviolent action. Anybody else? Yes.
Trusting the process of life, not getting in the way.
Wonderful. Yes. Self-trusting self, which means also trusting the larger flow of life, and not stopping it or not getting in the way is a very brilliant sort of nonviolent method of doing things. Do you want to say more about it?
I don't think so.
No. Yeah. Wonderful. Trust can't be overemphasized. An expression of gratitude is an expression of trust as well. And making sure that we express gratitude for our lives is a way of saying, I trust life's process. And it's a specific expression of it. Yeah, that's wonderful. I didn't know it until you just said that. Thank you. Yeah, Judith.
Remembering stillness, just that notion of remember, kind of the most important thing.
Remembering stillness.
Stillness.
Remembering stillness. Yeah. 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 The stillness is so important. It's nonviolent. It lets things settle. And whatever may be violent in our minds or our bodies or our thoughts, right, settle down. I think, I know I told you this before, but once when I was practicing with Thich Nhat Hanh, he had a big jug of unfiltered apple juice, and he shook it up, and all the pieces were flying all over the place, and then he put it on the ground and just left it there. And all of the stuff that was flying just settled to the bottom, and the juice became clear. And he said, this is meditation. Remembering, again, that we have not just the capacity, but we have a means for doing it. And using it, yeah.
Patience with self, and patience with self when those same things present themselves over and over. Mm-hmm. And we have to look at them over and over again, or let them go over and over again, mm-hmm. which is that.
That's right. Patience, well, this is a bit with trust, right? Patience with the process of life, which includes the fact that we do forget and that we do repeat the same cycle over and over again. And loving ourselves enough to be kind when that happens. You know, people in the Sangha know I have this little puppy, this new dog. So you'll never get the dog to do anything in a way that maintains the dog's integrity and happiness if you just scream at the dog. So even when the dog is doing something I don't want her to do, I say, Sasha. Puppy. You can't eat my shoe. I told you yesterday. She looks at me like, what is happening? And then she hears again, Sasha. You can't eat my shoe. I can't walk with you if I don't have a shoe. And she looks at me and she says, what's happening?
No, she says, what?
But actually, it's true. To be patient and kind when the same thing shows up is a very good nonviolent method of stopping violence. And I don't want to be, I don't want to depress you. Because my hope is that if we honestly acknowledge the ways in which we do hurt ourselves because we learned how to do it. You know, you have a wet ball of clay, nice wet ball of clay, that's like a little baby's mind. And you take a finger and you stick it into the clay and you pull the finger out. Now, exactly when will the impression that your finger made come out?
Never.
It will never come out. So we have to come up with a way to deal with the fact that that is now in there. And we can't keep poking at it because it just makes it worse. And we don't want to break it, but there are ways to deal with it. And that's a lot of what I'm talking about. Nonviolent ways to deal with the fact that there is harm that goes on in our human lives, that comes from our human lives, that then spills just as much as the bodhisattva vow spills into the world, so does the harm. We have a choice. Yes, Annika.
Well, for me, there's something there about critical inquiry too, like to just, when I have some of those, you know, negative thoughts, like it, which is how I do violence on myself, if I can stop and go, well, is that true? Mm. Is that technically actually true? Like, does everybody think that about myself? Or do I always do that? And, mm-hmm. you know, so then you can actually enlist your thinking mind on a little detective thing. Is this actually true? Is
yeah.
it even like... Yeah. Did that really happen?
Reality check.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, 1 Adam 12 is there. Am I really? Did I really say that? Yeah. No, that's right. A reality check. And also, if you have people close to you, you can just ask. Can you do me a favor? I'm thinking this about myself. Is that really true? Am I as annoying as I think I am? And then your friends say, well, I am your last friend. Okay, we should stop now. So I don't do violence to the schedule, but I would like to end with just a very brief meditation. So just sit quietly. We'll just do it for two persons. First, for us in general, may I be free from suffering and happy. May I be well. May I be safe. May I experience peacefulness and ease. May I be free from suffering and happy. May I be well. May I be safe. May I be peaceful and at ease. And to the part of me that hurts me, may you be free from suffering and be happy. May you be well. May you feel safe. May you find peace and be at ease. May you stop suffering and be happy. May you be well. May you be safe. You're safe. You're safe with me. May you find peace in that and ease. Thank you.